everyone. Good morning. I think today we're supposed to talk a little bit about relationships, and that's a very, very pivotal issue that people are very concerned about. First, let me start generally. You know, everyone knows the Ten Commandments, and the Ten Commandments are commonly divided into two columns. The first five are said to be the duties between man and God. Believe in God, don't believe in idols, don't take God's name in vain, observe the Shabbat. And the second five are considered to be the interpersonal duties. Don't steal, don't commit adultery, etc., which are called man and men. And we have two terms in Hebrew for them. Category one is called Bein Adam LaMakom, between man and God. Makom is place, but God is referred to as the place of the universe. And category two is called Bein Adam LaChaveiro, between man and man. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time on that particular division. There is actually one problem with that, because everyone knows what the fifth commandment is. The fifth commandment, I'm sure your parents must have told you this many times, honor thy father and mother. And the question is, why is that in column one? That seems to be interpersonal, right? So really it ought to be, instead of 5-5, it ought to be 4-6. But there are a lot of answers to that. One answer is that when we honor our parents, we learn gratitude for having life, and therefore that transfers to gratitude to the Almighty for giving you life. But okay, but be it as it may, there's an interesting point here in terms of font size. Moses comes down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of stone. And by the way, the two tablets were not joined. They were separate tablets, contrary to the picture. Now, the first five have many more words than the second five. Just more words, right? The second five are very staccato. Don't kill, don't steal, don't commit adultery, don't give false testimony, don't covet your neighbor's property. But they took up the same amount of space on the tablets. So in order for a fewer number of words to take up the same number of same amount of space, the letters must be much larger. So if you're watching Moses coming down from the mountain, and you're putting on your glasses and you're trying to squint and see what is on those tablets, which commandments are you going to see first? You're going to see the interpersonal commandments, because they were written in a larger, or engraved rather, in a larger size of letter. So this itself is at least an indirect thought that people sometimes misidentify what it means to be a religious person. A religious person is, of course, a person who believes in God and a person who wants to serve God. But people think the meaning of being religious is primarily I keep the Shabbos, I daven, I wear tefillin, all that is important. But you see over here that the way you treat other people is on some level even more important. Now, both are primary, both are vital, but it's a real big mistake when we interpret religion exclusively in terms of the ritualistic commandments, and we don't look at the obligation and the responsibility of kindness, of compassion, of love, of caring, of concern. So, in a sense, if somebody would ever ask you, how come some religious Jews are not kind and compassionate people? So I could answer, although it's a little bit of a wise guy answer, well, anyone that does not treat people with kindness is not religious. That's like asking, how come some religious Jews don't keep Shabbos? Well, the short answer is, anybody would say, well, what do you mean? Every religious Jew keeps Shabbos, because if you don't keep Shabbos, you're not a religious Jew. So you can't possibly say, how come some religious Jews don't keep kosher? So I would submit to you that the same way we would say that the definition of being religious means you keep Shabbos and you keep kosher, the definition of being religious means you treat people with dignity and with kindness and with compassion. That is part of that same Torah. And as that little homily I showed you about the Ten Commandments, perhaps it is even a more important part of the Torah and the like. Do you remember there's a famous story in the Gemara, maybe you've heard this story before, about a non-Jew wants to convert to Judaism. It's in the Talmud. And he first goes to Shammai, a great rabbi, and says to Shammai, teach me the whole Torah while I stand on one foot. Yeah, give me a short soundbite. So Shammai kicks him out of the house. He says, you know, get out of here, you idiot. You know, I don't need people who just scoff around. He then goes to the great sage Hillel, who was renowned for his patience. And Hillel says, yeah, I'll teach you the whole Torah in one foot. What is hateful to you, do not do to another. You don't want people to hurt you. You don't want people to disregard your feelings. You don't want people to be insensitive to you. Anything that would hurt you, don't do to anybody else. V'idach, and the rest of the Torah, of course, there's a lot more to learn. Go and learn it. I'm just giving you a one-line synopsis of what the Torah is about. Now, let's ponder this story a little bit, because there are really two questions you could ask about this story. Question number one, and Christianity uses this as a criticism of Judaism. This is sometimes described as the negative golden rule. Instead of saying, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, you'll notice it is phrased in the negative. What is hurtful to you, do not do to another. So you'll sometimes see in the writings of Christian polemicists the idea that Christian morality is a higher level than Pharisaic or rabbinic morality. Because rabbinic morality simply espouses the ethic of not hurting people, as opposed to Christian morality that advocates the higher cause of loving people and giving people goodness. And the theory goes, the positive is higher than the negative. But that obviously is not true, because the very verse that Jesus cites in the New Testament, love thy neighbor as you love yourself, is taken from the Jewish Bible, and it appears in the book of Leviticus. So yeah, Jesus may have said, love your neighbor as you love yourself, but that's in the Torah. He didn't invent that. So the question is actually a good question. If indeed Judaism espouses not merely the negative ethic of not hurting people, but the positive ethic of showing love, then why does Hillel utilize the lower level of not hurting people? Because one would assume it is spiritually higher to help people affirmatively than simply not to hurt them. Right, so that's question number one I want to ask. Why does Hillel use the negative instead of the positive, especially since the Torah itself uses the positive, love your friend or love your neighbor as you love yourself? The second question is, how is that the whole Torah? I mean, I understand it embraces all of the interpersonal commandments, charity and kindness, but I don't see in that statement putting on tefillin, keeping kosher, what is hateful to you don't do to somebody else. Right? How does that pick up the whole Torah? At most, it picks up 50% of the Torah. So the second question I can answer, Rashi actually gives us a beautiful answer. Rashi says, when Hillel says, what is hateful to you, do not do to your friend. The term friend has a double meaning. Friend is my fellow human being, and friend is also God. It's a very beautiful thought. That God is described in many ways. God is described as our father, God is described as our king, but God is also described as our friend, and that's a very comforting idea. When a person feels lost, a person feels alone, a person feels lonely, God is with them. God is there to be a source of comfort, a source of support. You know, we'll talk about this a little later on, but we say, you know, how come God doesn't answer prayers, right? But the point of the matter is, if a person is going through a hard time, and even if things don't come out the way they wanted it to come out, but God was there giving him the strength to get up in the morning, to put one foot in front of the other foot, to keep on going, that's also God in that place. So therefore, when Hillel says to the non-Jew, what is hateful to you, do not do to another, to your friend, he's including don't hurt God by violating his will. So as a result, there is a double meaning. But to go back to the first question, why does Hillel use the negative instead of the positive? And the short answer is, those of you that are planning on going to medical school will learn quickly that the first rule of medicine is do no harm. That is, before you start trying to save the world, before you start trying to do good, before you start trying to say, I know exactly what you need and I'm going to give it, you first have to step back and be sure you know the person, you appreciate the person, that what you're doing is not going to hurt that person, what you're doing is not going to steamroll that person's awareness of themselves. Meaning, in point of fact, before you can do good, you have to be sure you're not doing harm. Let me give you a trivial example. It's a small example. Let's say, you know, when people are sick, people have a flu, whatever it is, they react to it in different ways. Some people just want to go into a cave, They just want to close the door. They don't want company. They don't want calls. They don't want chicken soup. They just want to be left alone so they could sleep for 18 hours or whatever. Other people kind of want to be babied a little bit. Maybe it's a man-woman difference to some degree. They want someone to make chicken soup for them. They want someone to come over. They want someone to talk, etc. Now, let's imagine that you're the typical, you know, guy in the cave who says, I just want to be left alone. And every 15 minutes you have your good friends coming over, or your girlfriend even, coming over with chicken soup, and you say, well, I really can't eat, I just want to sleep. She says, I spent 5 hours making this soup for you, and you're not going to take it. Well, is she trying to help you, or is this simply what makes her feel good, and therefore you're the person that she wants to use? So before you start helping people, be sure you're responsive to their needs. And that is why Hillel starts off with the negative, because you really can't help a person till you know what that person really needs. People are not simply objects through which I can do my good deeds. You know what they tell the story about? Even good deeds can be selfishly motivated. They tell a story, this is kind of a bizarre story, but it's a cute story, about a man, a boy in yeshiva, had learned a teaching. I'm not even aware of this teaching, but it says that if you marry a bad wife, your suffering will be so great that you're guaranteed a place in the world to come. So somehow this really got the guy, and the guy was determined to marry the worst woman that he could possibly marry. So he turned down all of the good shidduchim, and finally he found a woman that was bitter and angry and selfish. And people said, are you crazy? What do you want to do? He said, nope, that's the one. So he marries her, and he's really, really excited because, you know, 30, 40 years, 50 years, and then he'll go straight to Olam Haba, you know, small price to pay. So the next morning, all of a sudden, she's sweet, she's gentle, she brings him breakfast in bed, you know, she does everything, she waits on him, hand and foot, and he's getting very, very nervous. What is going on here? And after a week of this extreme kindness, he says to her, you know, I appreciate how nice you are, but that's not really the deal that I thought we had. That's not really the understanding. You know, you were a different type of person when we got married. So she says to him, if you think you're going to go to Olam Haba because of me, you've got another thing coming. You know, so the concept is that even kindness sometimes is the way of hurting people, or the way of self-aggrandizement. We're really doing it for ourselves. Okay. So let me just say that it's very, very important. And again, I don't mean to put myself up as any example. I mean, all of us have our failings and deficiencies. But as an ideal of what it means to be a religious Jew is supposed to be an exemplar of kindness, of sensitivity, of compassion, of tolerance. And sometimes, in the polarized world we live in, you'll sometimes see that religion might make a person uptight and a bit condemnatory and a bit judgmental, but they're going in the wrong way. If that's where it takes them, they're not properly internalizing the teachings of Judaism. Now, it's a little bit of a tightrope, because obviously Judaism does have a code of ethics. Judaism is not moral relativism. Judaism doesn't say, I'm okay, you're okay, and whatever goes, goes. There are standards, and the standards have to be upheld, but they have to be upheld with kindness and respect for the inherent dignity of other human beings, Jews and non-Jews, going back to what we discussed, that man is made in the image of God. Man, women are made in the image of God, and therefore everyone is entitled to a basic respect and dignity for who they are and for the godliness that is within. Now, in particular, although this applies to all our relationships, let's talk a little bit about man-woman relationships. First of all, the idea of sexuality in Judaism is very, very different than either other religious traditions on one side, and certainly the secular world on the other side. In some religious traditions, sexuality is seen as essentially an evil that is tolerated because there's no choice. Paul said in the New Testament, better to marry than to burn, meaning people are going to commit sexual offenses anyway, so God said, let them have marriage as an outlet. But ideally, if you're a holy person, the goal of holiness is to be celibate. Now, we know how well that's worked for the Catholic Church, indeed. But at least that is the theory. The theory is that sex is bad. Sex is evil. The man-woman relationship is fundamentally tainted, and therefore the more you can get away from it, the better. Judaism, on the other hand, teaches that not only is celibacy not required, but celibacy is actually a sin in some ways, within marriage, I mean, that one is supposed to get married, there's a mitzvah to get married. The very first commandment in the 613 commandments of the Torah is to be fruitful and multiply. We consider the sexual union to be sanctified and holy. In fact, that is why one of the time-honored Jewish customs is that the holiest night of the week was often set aside for marital intimacy, and that is Friday night. The very fact that it's holy, one engages in a holy activity. However, this also sharply distinguishes Judaism from the secular world. In the secular world, sex is seen as simply a way of getting gratification, a way of getting physical pleasure. There is not always a spiritual dimension attached to it. In Judaism, it is the holiness of marital intimacy that requires that it be within a sanctified relationship. The very word for marriage is kiddushin. That is what marriage means. And kiddushin actually means sanctification, holiness. That intimacy is a function of holiness. It is related to holiness. I don't mean to say that the only purpose of intimacy is having children. Certainly having children is a goal and it's a mitzvah. But even if a couple is infertile, even if a couple is, the woman is post-menopause, or the man is not capable of having children, there is an independent mitzvah for man and woman to connect in an intimate way. We consider that to be very, very holy. And therefore, if indeed we talk about these matters with privacy, with reserve, we don't necessarily exhibit a lot of behavior, it is not because it is something shameful, but because it is something so elevated that it is kept within the confines of the intimacy of the family unit. Now, let's go back to the creation of Adam and Eve. If you read the Torah in Genesis, it seems to be first there was Adam, and then there was Eve. But in fact, there's a rabbinic tradition that looks at it the other way, that the initial creation of man was a man-woman unit, a man-woman unit, kind of like Siamese twins. And when God created Eve, what that really means is he simply separated them so they would be separate, so they would be separate entities and able to mate. Remember, Adam was looking for a mate. He couldn't find a mate, so God made Adam fall asleep, and then he took Eve from him. And what did God say? God said, Lo tov, heyotz ha'adam levado. It is not good for man to be alone. Let me make a helpmate to be opposite him. And I'm going to analyze, basically the remainder of my talk, I'm simply going to analyze that single beautiful verse. It is not good for man to be alone. I will make a helpmate to be opposite. Now keep in mind that this verse was said when Adam is in the Garden of Eden. In the Garden of Eden, what is so wrong about being alone? You have everything you want. There's one little tree you're not supposed to eat, but that's fine. You can eat everything else. You don't need laundry or tailoring. You're walking around naked. You have unlimited pleasure. You have an infinite capacity to enjoy the world. What is so bad about man being alone? So one of the commentaries offers a beautiful insight. One of the commentaries say that the word tov, good, the ultimate good is God himself. What is good about God? What is the quality of goodness? Goodness is selfless giving. Because God can only give. God cannot take. Because there's nothing that you can give to God that God doesn't already have. So God is the epitome of giving. Goodness is giving. Man in the Garden of Eden, without a helpmate, has an infinite capacity to take. But he cannot be godly if he has no one to whom to give. So when it says it is not good for man to be alone, we can retranslate it a little bit. We can tweak the Hebrew by saying man cannot be good in a state of aloneness, because the meaning of good is giving. Man in a state of aloneness can be a taker, but cannot be a giver. And therefore, man, the human being, can never be godly until they transcend the egotism and the selfishness of the taker and learn to become a giver. By the way, you know, we know that the Dead Sea, in Hebrew, it's not called the Dead Sea, it's called the Yam HaMelech, the Salt Sea, because of the concentration of minerals. But the common English name is Dead Sea. Now, why is it called the Dead Sea? Because obviously the mineral content is so high that no fish can live in the Dead Sea. I don't know if you've been down to the Dead Sea. But homiletically, somebody once said, the reason why it's called the Dead Sea is because water flows into it, but no water flows out of it. When you take and you don't give, you're dead. The meaning of being spiritually alive is to give. And therefore, this is an amazing thing. So if we ask ourselves why God created the man-woman relationship, why God created marriage, God created marriage to make me or my spouse a godly person by learning to give rather than taking. So you may remember, this is again before you were born, but I'm sure you read about it, the very famous inaugural address of John F. Kennedy. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Well, with marriage, it's exactly the same thing. Ask not what your marriage can do for you. Because marriage wasn't created to give me self-gratification. Marriage was created as a structure to enable me to transcend my egotism, my selfishness, my narrowness, my preoccupation with me, to learn to truly care about another human being. And by transcending that selfishness and egotism, one becomes a more godly person. Because when we're filled with ourselves, there is no room for anything else.
So, I completely understand all the points, to give, to be selfless, but what is, my question would be, how can one find that motivation to actually make those changes?
Right, I'll come to that. Those are obviously very good questions. Yeah, we'll hopefully address some of them. Yeah, but it is a very important and good point. You know, so this is the thing. You know, there's a story about a fellow in the yeshiva, another yeshiva story, where he was ravenously eating fish. He was sitting in the dining room eating fish. So one of the rabbis went over to him and said, "Why are you eating fish?" So the boy said, "I love fish. That's why I'm eating it." So the rabbi says, "You mean if you love something, you chew it and spit out the bones? If you love the fish, you would put it in an aquarium. You don't mean you love fish, you mean you love yourself. And you're using the fish for your self-gratification." In the world that we live in, when I often say I love this person, I love that person in the same way I love that fish, meaning to say, they're giving me what I want, they're giving me what I need, they're giving me what I want to take, and when they don't anymore, I chew them up, spit the bones, and throw them out. We live in a disposable society. If the phone doesn't work, throw it away. If the computer doesn't work, get a new model. If the baby doesn't work, or the pregnancy doesn't work, abort it. God forbid if the baby doesn't work. Sometimes even that happens. And the like. So, marriage is about learning to look after somebody beyond yourself. And that's very hard. That is not easy. That is not instinctive. Because although it's true, as Aristotle said, man is a social animal. We, of course, crave company and we crave companionship. But it's not so natural to care about another person more than you even care about yourself. And yet the Talmud says, one must love one's wife as much as they love themselves. One must honor one's wife more than they honor themselves. So when people say Judaism is misogynist or anti-women, one should ponder statements like that in terms of what Judaism teaches. Now, there is a certain subtlety here, and that is the following. It's not yet your question, but it's another question that's related. And that is, sometimes learning to be a giver actually means you have to be a taker. Let's imagine I hear this type of speech and I say, I'm going to give. I'm going to be a giver. And you'll never let the other person do anything for you. How are they going to feel? You know, they say the following. There's an old cliche around, and it's true. Most cliches are true. That's why they're repeated so much. That one of the fundamental differences between men and women is, will you ask directions when you're lost? Now, Baruch Hashem, we have GPSs invented by male engineers, so we don't need to ask directions anymore. But in the olden days, when we didn't have the GPS, a man doesn't like to, I'll include myself. We don't like to ask directions. We're driving around, we're getting lost. We have to be lost for at least 2 hours till we break down and ask somebody for help. But when I'm going with my wife on a trip, we're pulling out of the driveway, and she would say, do you have directions? Let's go stop, ask right away. I said, no, we're not even lost yet. Why do we have to ask any directions? Now, this is a superficial observation, but it's actually a very deep observation. And the deep observation is that, and the Zohar says, Kabbalistically, there's a reason for this. If you assume, now this is not the opinion I told you a few moments ago, that first there was man and then there was woman, as opposed to simultaneous. It's a machlokas, an argument in the Gemara. It turns out that man's initial moments in this world were aloneness. He was not born into relationship. Relationship came later. As a result, the male's fundamental sense of autonomy is control, power. I don't need other people. That's why men don't cry. That's why men are tough. That's why men don't often have the intimate friendships that women have. You don't talk about your feelings. We hang around with sports and, get a beer or whatever it would be. Or even if we talk about, intellectual problems. But we very rarely talk about deep emotions. And that is because the essential first moments defined our identity. Our identity is about autonomy, control, and power. Man was born alone, but women entered a world of relationship. Women never existed in the world without a relationship. As a result, the nature of the male is to seek aloneness and a lack of dependency on others. Because when you reach out to others, that is a threat to your very sense of self. As opposed to a woman who looks at collaboration and community and connection. Again, I understand I'm generalizing, but these are generalizations that are largely true, although obviously there are exceptions, because every man has feminine elements within their personality, every woman has masculine elements. But it can be fairly said, I think, that the masculine element focuses on autonomy and self-sufficiency, and the woman's element focuses on relationships and interconnectivity. In fact, there was a famous classic work of social psychology written by Professor Carol Gilligan. She was a professor at Harvard University. I believe she died a few years ago. And this dates back to the early 80s. It was called A Different Voice. And this was a response to the feminist movement that tried to argue that all differences between men and women were based on environmental and cultural factors and were not innate. And therefore, there ought not to be any distinctions. And she gave a number of psychological tests to very young children, as young as 5 or 6. And she wanted to show that from a very early age, boys and girls look at the world in different ways. Now, I suppose you could argue they've already been culturally conditioned by age 5, but she tried to show that as far back as you go, you are going to see significant differences. And the particular hypothetical that she used involved the following case. Let's say you had a child. She's asking 5-year-old kids this question. You had a child, and the child is very sick. and that if the child doesn't have certain medicine, the child's going to die. And there's only one drugstore that has that medicine, and the drugstore's at the corner, but the drugstore is closed for the night. But there is a plate glass window. What do you do for your child? So every single boy answered, you take a rock, you break the glass, and you take the medicine. Now, that's a perfectly fine answer. If you have to save your kid's life, that's what you do. But every girl that was asked the question also said, be sure to leave a note with your phone number on it, or call the police ahead of time to tell them this is what you're going to do. Now, what was the point of this difference? Gilligan said that men tend to be fixated. They tend to identify the primary issue at hand, and they focus laser-like on the yes or the no. What's the most important thing? We focus, gotta do this. A woman has an awareness of the web of interconnected relationships that are affected. That when I break a window, it's not just a question of getting medicine for my child. There are other people that are involved. There's going to be glass in the street and people are going to get hurt. There's going to be property damage. And you don't ignore the other relationships by fixation on the primary goal. That is why, you know, a man might look at a woman and say, you're scatterbrained. Again, please forgive the cliches here. But the concept is, scatterbrainedness comes from looking at so many things at the same time. A woman might say to her husband, you're clueless because you're focusing, right? That's why don't interrupt a man during a football game. You're focusing. You're concentrating. Right? That is why men, I'm sorry for all these generalizations, but that is why men are mainly the great restaurant chefs, because when you're a great restaurant chef, you got to stir that soup for 4 hours, staring, thinking of nothing else. A woman doesn't have time to that, multitasking. Meaning, the concept that Professor Gilligan developed was that men are fixated on a single goal at any given moment in time. A woman perceives a web of relationships. Now, because of all of this, a man is often reluctant to surrender his autonomy and his control. Now, here is the subtlety. In order to be a giver, you must be vulnerable enough to let the other person give to you. Because when you let the other person give to you, you're actually giving them the most valuable gift of all, the gift of self-esteem, the gift that they are valuable in your life, the gift that they are needed. You see how important that is? Imagine a situation where I'm just the giver, 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 giver. Well, what does that make the other person feel like? It feels like they're not contributing anything. They're not needed. So when I say the goal is to be a giver, to be a true giver, you have to be willing to accept. You can't be the strong, silent male that is always giving and not being open. You have to expose the vulnerability. So that's one important point. That yes, the purpose of relationships is to learn to give. But learning to give requires that you be a taker as well. Not in a selfish way, but in a way of showing the other person that you need them. That a rabbi once remarked, it was a very, very good way of saying it. As important as it is to say you love somebody, it's also important to communicate the message, not just I love you, but I need you. You add something to my life. You bring something to my life. You give me something I otherwise would not have. That's very, very important. And that's something that perhaps we're very, very reluctant to even admit to ourselves. But it is that vulnerability that can be the root of true love, because you really feel that you need somebody. Now, yeah.
With to the point of admitting that you need someone, the question arises within generally and increasingly equalizing society between men and women. You see that you see more independent women in society. You think that's a very big maybe obstacle?
Well, I think it is a very big obstacle. But again, you know, when I say needing somebody, I don't necessarily limit that to the narrow idea that my wife needs me to support her or vice versa. But we're talking about emotional connection. That I need you because you understand me, you care about me, and that's something that adds value to my life. When a woman feels that, or a man feels that, that builds and strengthens a relationship. They don't feel they're just a hang around. They don't feel they're just taking. Because remember, if I'm the one that's always giving, then the other one is always taking. How does a person, or vice versa, how does a person feel if they're always taking? They don't feel that good either. Right? So in a healthy relationship, selfless giving does require that balance of taking from the other. Now, it's a little tricky. On one hand, I can tell you the goal of marriage is giving, but what if I'm treated like a doormat? What if, you know, I marry somebody who only wants to take? Obviously, we have to function in the real world. And, you know, we have to have somebody that is also willing to give to me. And that's a careful, now one has to be very careful in choosing a marriage partner. It's not an automatic thing. You don't pick a name out of a hat, or you don't simply look for the most beautiful person, or whatever, at least most beautiful externally person, look for the most beautiful person inside. You look for qualities of kindness and gentleness and modesty and the like. But I will tell you an interesting dynamic. The dynamic is that let me put it this way, the less selfish you are in a relationship, the more your selfish needs are going to get addressed. It's quite an amazing thing. That when a woman feels, and I'm speaking to men, I'm talking about what we do impacts on women, but the same thing would be the other way around. When a woman feels that you truly care about her, when a woman feels you're not using her, when a woman feels you respect her, when a woman feels that she's needed in your life, she will go out of her way to give you what you need. That's kind of the paradox. The less selfish you are, the more you will get what you want. The more selfish you are, the less you will get what you want. So, in a sense, altruistic selflessness is the most selfish thing you can do. Because if you want in your life A, B, C, and D, the less selfish you are and the more giving you are, the more you're going to get it. That's the way it is. Because when a woman feels loved, she will do everything to make you happy. When a woman feels you're just using her, that creates resentment, coldness, breakdown of relationship, and then you'll get nothing at all. Okay, so one has to keep aware of this, that we're not telling a person you don't have needs. A person has needs in all sorts of ways, but the best way of getting those needs is becoming less of a selfish person. So it is something to think about, and I think this is very, very common. I mean, again, our commentaries tell us that because a woman is called a helpmate to man, a woman naturally wants to give, wants to help, wants to support you, wants to build you up. But if a woman feels rejected and not appreciated, that turns into anger. And there's a beautiful homily that the rabbis say about this. The Hebrew word for man, now Adam is a name, but what is the Hebrew word for man? Anyone knows? Ish. The Hebrew word for woman is Isha. Now, it's interesting, I don't have a blackboard here, but it's interesting that they share two common letters, Aleph Shin, which means fire, and the man has a Yud, and the woman has a Hey, and that spells God's name. So it says when God is in their relationship, meaning they're subservient to God's law, men are men, women are women, things work out well. Take out the Yud and take out the Hey, they become like two fires that destroy each other with their egotism and their anger and their animosity. Okay, so you have a choice. Keep God in your relationship and there's holiness. Take God out, you have destructive fire. Okay, so these are some things to think about. Now, does this mean things are going to be smooth sailing? Absolutely not. There are going to be disagreements. There are going to be fights. Unfortunately, sometimes there's going to be anger. But when there is this willingness to give, you will be able to work things out most of the time. You will go through the difficult times, but confident and secure in each other, you will be able to weather those storms. And that brings me now to the second half of the verse. So what did God say? It is not good for man to be alone. Let us make a helpmate to be opposite. First of all, helpmate. You know, some people in modern society, some people look at that as an inferior type of role, to be a helpmate. And yet, to be there for another person. There is nothing as great as that. God Himself is called our helpmate. And when I can help another person become what they're able to become, that is a very, very great, great accomplishment. But look at the verse. It is not good for man to be alone. Let us make a helpmate to be opposite him. So the rabbis of the Talmud have a problem. Helpmate seems to imply we're working together. Opposite implies we're in opposition. So is it opposition or is it helpmate? How can it be a helpmate in opposition? So the Talmud gives a pragmatic answer. It says, well, some people get one, some people get the other. Some people get a relationship that's helpmate, and some people get a relationship that's opposition. Meaning God is saying, you know, marriages turn out different ways. But in the Hasidic books, it gives us a different explanation. It says that the helpmate of the marriage is precisely the opposition. What do we mean by this? All of us, well, I'll tell you, let me start with this. I once came across in an airport gift shop, a wind-up toy. And this was a little doll that was intended for beleaguered middle management executives. And you wind up this doll, and this doll just says, you're great, you're wonderful, you never make a mistake, people don't appreciate you. And it's a way of, you know, building up your confidence after having a hard day at work. At least this little doll appreciates who I am. Now, all of us, whether it's the husband or the wife, because most of what I'm saying applies to both sides of this, you know, we have a hard time in the world out there. You know, work was difficult, school was difficult, people didn't appreciate us, we may have had a rough day at the office. And we want to be able to come home and have somebody say to us, you know, you're great, you're smart, you're so brilliant, everything you say is so true. And of course, in a good marriage, there has to be a lot of that. There has to be a lot of stroking, a lot of building people up. And that's what you do. But marriage has to be more than that. Because if marriage is simply confirming me in whatever I am, I never grow, I never become better, I never improve. To marry your clone is almost meaningless, because why have double you? You're already who you are. Two of you is going to be no better. So in many, many ways, the true love of a marriage is when husband and wife, man and woman, see the world in fundamentally different ways, and each one expands their horizons by seeing it from the vantage point of the other. Again, not in a critical way, not in a judgmental way, not in a sarcastic or insulting way. But ultimately, my wife should help me to see life in a different way. I should help her. And by the different perceptions we have, we achieve a wholeness and a truth that either one of us would not have been able to achieve by ourselves. This is literally the sum is greater, or the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And that is what it means, Ezer. The help is connecto, that we see the world differently. The help of a marriage is not that we both see things the same, but it's precisely the fact that we see things in a different way. In fact, that is why, although there are many, 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 many deeper reasons than this, but one of the issues of why marriage needs to be heterosexual instead of homosexual, although there are many, many more reasons, and this is really a talk for another time, is that it's precisely the fact that men and women are fundamentally different, that the union has to be predicated on two different ways of viewing the world coming together, as opposed to a replication of the same. Although I understand that that is not a complete explanation for the opposition to gay marriage. So as a result, although in a marriage there must be emotional support, no question, but there should be the ability to communicate different viewpoints to create something richer. So disagreement should not be the cause for animosity, should not be the cause for resentment. It should be understood as the gift of relationship is that I can broaden my vision by incorporating the vision of another. The Gemara says there's a similar story, not about marriage, but about Torah learning. There was a great rabbi, Rabbi Yochanan. And Rabbi Yochanan had a brother-in-law who was also his disciple, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. Actually, there's quite a backstory to this. Shimon ben Lakish, in his early years, was a bandit. He was a highway robber. He would rob people. And he once attacked Rabbi Yochanan. And he was going to kill Rabbi Yochanan. But Rabbi Yochanan said that, you know, if you study Torah, I will give you my sister for marriage. This is without asking your sister. But basically, Rabbi Yochanan was very beautiful, physically very, very handsome, and my sister is even more beautiful. And Rav Shimon ben Lakish dropped his career, and Rav Shimon ben Lakish became a great Talmudic scholar. He married Rav Yochanan's sister, and he became Rav Yochanan's colleague, student colleague. And every time Rav Yochanan would give a teaching, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish would give 24 questions and refutations that Rav Yochanan had to answer. Anyway, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish died and was replaced by another rabbi. And this rabbi was very supportive. Every time Rabbi Yochanan said something, this rabbi gave him 24 reasons that he was right. Really good yes man. 24 reasons that I'm right. The man started, Rabbi Yochanan started crying and sobbing, and he said, I miss Reish Lakish so much. So the student said to him, what do you mean? Reish Lakish was giving you trouble. Every time you said something, Reish Lakish raised 24 questions. And this rabbi gives you 24 reasons that you're right. You ought to be happy with it. Rav Yochanan said, I didn't need somebody to tell me I'm right. If I didn't think I was right, I wouldn't have said what I said. But when Rav Shimon ben Lakish would challenge me, I was forced to reconsider my position. I was forced to think I either was able to answer and come to a deeper understanding, or I realized I made a mistake and I corrected and modified my position. That is how richness emerges. That is how truth emerges, through the dialectic of shared communication. That is why in our own Talmudic learning, we learn b'chavrusa, right? Chavrusa means we kind of create pairs and the like, so people discuss and see things differently. So marriage is very much that same idea. Ezer, the helpmate, comes from the kenegdo, the different ways of viewing ideas. Men and women are not supposed to be the same. It's fundamentally axiomatic that equality of dignity is not sameness of function, and it is not identity of perception. Men and women are supposed to see the world in different ways, but each one shares their perception to the other. A man can become more, I'm just again going back with my stereotype before, if a man tends to be fixated on a single idea, a woman can teach him sensitivity to relationships. If a woman is scatterbrained, going from this to this, a man can help a woman be more focused. So each person learns from the other how to be better. Each person gains an understanding that transcends their parochialism. Now, it takes humility to do that, because we like to think we're perfect. We like to think, you know, I'm going to be the giver, I'm going to be the perfect one. But part of being in a good relationship is you're willing to admit, at least to yourself, that I can learn, I can grow, I can be corrected. Of course, one has to be careful. There's a famous story, they say, with George Bernard Shaw. Right? You all have heard of Shaw, the famous playwright, and Isadora Duncan. Isadora Duncan was one of the famous ballerinas of the late 19th, the early 20th century. So she was a bit of a flirt. So one time at a banquet, she said to Shaw, you know, Mr. Shaw, with my beauty and your brains, we could produce beautiful children. So Shaw said, that is 100% true, but what if the kids have your brains and my beauty? We're going to be in trouble. So sometimes it could happen. I enter a relationship, each one of us picks up the bad characteristics of the other. That's a little negative. But hopefully, each one of us identifies the good, and we incorporate it into our personalities, and therefore the man incorporates some of the feminine attributes, the woman incorporates some of the masculine attributes. Each one achieves a perfection and a wholeness they would not achieve alone, and that is really kind of the goal of a relationship. So this is very, very important. You know, it's an amazing thing, and it doesn't cease to amaze me how much time we invest in learning how to do our jobs and learning how to make money and the like, you know, all of our schooling, all of our college, our graduate work, and the like, and the hours we spend every day, and how little time we spend in learning how to build up, number one, our spiritual lives, and number two, our relationships. If people would invest a fraction of the time in their relationships that they invest in their jobs, the divorce rate would go down exponentially. And yet, we just assume that good marriages happen by themselves. Good parenting just happens. Just have your kids. Well, cities don't get built by themselves. Armies don't get organized by themselves. It takes planning, it takes work, it takes thoughts, it takes introspection, it takes study. Why should the same not be true for the important ideas of marriage, relationships, raising our kids? We got to put in the time to think about these things, because ultimately that is what life is about. When a person will be leaving this world after 120 years, the last thoughts that are going to go through their mind, if they're conscious, are not going to be, I wish I spent more time at the office. Gee, why didn't I go in more Sundays, you know, to work? You're not going to be thinking about that. But it is very likely a person will be thinking about how they treated their wife, how do they treat their kids. Those are the issues that are going to hound us at the very end of our lives. And if, thank God, we have a chance to do something about them now, or think of, at least think about them now, then should we not take that advantage? So, God willing, I hope that all of you will find and develop, not just, I don't want to just say find your relationship, because it's not just about finding, but find, develop, and work on your relationships, and may God bless you all to find your partners in life, people that you can go through life with joy and with depth and with growth, and eventually also bring up children in a good way. So you all have a good day.